Hello, friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Before we take you to your favorite Sports History Network show, just want to tell you a little bit about some merch that you can pick up. It represents your favorite SHN podcast. So far, there's t-shirts, coffee mugs, and even books from some of the authors that do podcasts right here on SHN. Who could buy something better than that than have the history right from the gentleman that you hear talking about it? But we also are adding things each and every day. And where's that store, may you ask? Well, it's at SportsHistoryNetwork.com. Up at the top, there is the SHN merch button. Click on that. It'll take you right to the store, and you can be representing your favorite podcast and show the world that, hey, on the swag that I'm using, it's the headquarters of Sports Yesteryear, Sports History Network, and my favorite podcaster, the Sports History Network store. Shop there today. Are you ready for one great ride through the gridiron history with the story of one family? Well, we have Upton Bell coming up in an interview in just a moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we're broadcasting from the Pig Pen in Western Pennsylvania to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So with Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff supplying us with the tunes, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome to the football history headlines for February 25th. And as we said at the tease in the beginning of this show, we have a great guest today, Mr. Upton Bell, with what I'm going to call the first family of football. Never have I experienced a journey of one family involved with the sport of football like this gentleman has his story to tell us today, because it is phenomenal. Make sure you stick with it. But before we get to that, let's get to our football history headlines. February 25th, 1933. One major NFL rule revisions took place in respect to the field of play as the league, after its first 13 seasons, followed the NCAA gridiron rules and decided to write its own rule book. The first order of business was to try to offset the great number of game outcomes that resulted in ties by putting the goalposts just a little bit closer to promote field goals and increase scoring. The goalposts were put on the goal lines in this case, and just let the kickers have a little bit shorter kick. The other field change was to move the hash marks 10 yards closer to each other than the college fields, so that a more wide open field of play would be allowed to let playmakers make plays around the ends. Before we bring our special guest that we alluded to earlier on the program, I want to make sure, take care of a couple programming notes. First of all, I want you to check out the sportshistorynetwork.com, because Arnie Chapman has gathered together, including this podcast, 17 other podcasts at the time of this recording, that just have talking about sports history in all kinds of great ways with some great hosts and some very special guests, just like the one you're going to hear here in a moment, Mr. Upton Bell. But this Sports History Network covers all sports, not just the sport of football. It covers all sports, and we're always looking to get some more talent into the Sports History Network to become partners with us to present sports history in one place, to be the home of sports yesteryear. That's the obligation. That's the mission statement of the Sports History Network. So we want to make sure you join us. If you go to sportshistorynetwork.com, if you're interested, and you can contact Arnie Chapman there, and he can get you hooked up and get you on your way to podcasting or blogging about your favorite sport to bring your knowledge to the rest of the world. Now, I'd like to talk about our football history headlines, our birthdays of Hall of Famers, and we have just one today, and as we alluded to earlier, it is Mr. Burt Bell. Just let me tell you a little bit about Burt Bell. I don't want to steal any of Upton's thunder in the interview, but as we always do, we want to tell you about our Hall of Fame birthdays. February 25th, 1895, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Burt Bell, the former founder and owner of the Philadelphia Eagles, co-owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, and legendary commissioner of the National Football League, was born. Bell had his fingerprints all over the NFL's history for some 27 years as he established policies such as recognizing the NFLPA, the NFL draft creation, overtime for tie games, and establishing a precedent for NFL television contracts, with so much more, as Upton's going to tell us in a second. I'm just going to preface this by saying Burt Bell Sr. was enshrined into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1963, and now we have the true privilege of honoring Mr. Bell with his awesome contributions by having his son, a gridiron legend himself, Upton Bell, as a guest on our podcast to discuss Burt Bell Sr. Please give a lesson for the football history, a lesson of a lifetime, with Mr. Upton Bell. We are truly blessed and honored in this episode to talk to a living legend and a great football historian, Upton Bell. You know what? He's beyond a historian, as most of what he's going to share with us today is truly gridiron history that he's lived through. Upton Bell is the son of Frances Upton, a famous Broadway actress and comedian of the 1920s and 1930s, and Burt Bell, the National Football League commissioner from 1946 through 1959. Growing up inside the early NFL, Upton worked his way up the ranks of the Baltimore Colts organization, and those teams in his tenure in Baltimore were in two NFL championship games and two Super Bowl games, winning Super Bowl V in 1971. In 1971, Upton was hired to become the general manager of the Boston Patriots. In the mid-70s, he co-owned with partners, including Arnold Palmer, being one of them, the New York Stars in the World Football League. Then he relocated the team to Charlotte and rebranded them as the Charlotte Hornets. After the WFL, Upton began a long media career where he interviewed a long list of celebrities, including President George H.W. Bush, Howard Cosell, Bill Parcells, and even Stephen Hawking. He is also an accomplished author, present at the creation, My Life in the NFL and the Rise of America's Game. Will we present to you Upton Bell? Upton, welcome to the Pigpen.
I love it, the Pigpen. Darren, it's great to be on. By the way, also, as far as that book is, by the way, President the Creation, is still selling 3 years later and doing well around America in the paperback. And also, one other thing I did want to add in is just about a month ago, the Upton Bell Collection at the University of Massachusetts Amherst was opened with 144 artifacts that go all the way back to my great-grandfather and all the way back to the Abraham Lincoln cabinet. So there's all sorts of history in that, and I invite your audience and all the people listening to you to go online and click on the Upton Bell Collection at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and they'll be able to go through it and see all of the incredible things that are in there, including my Super Bowl ring and Burt Bell's 1917 gold football from the University of Pennsylvania, and pictures of my grandfather, who played in the stocking cap era in the 1885s, and my father when he was captain of Penn. So I've done my spiel, so go ahead.
Okay, well, we're going to put that link up on the show notes of this podcast, and we'll also put it up on pigskindispatch.com so everybody can go. If you want to go quick link right now, we're talking to Mr. Bell. It's www.umass.edu, and make sure you go to the Amherst Libraries and go into their search button and search on Upton Bell, and you'll see these great displays that Upton is talking about. And as he's talking, you can visualize them by seeing them. Mr. Bell, I would like to start off our discussion.
Please call me Upton.
Okay, I'm sorry, Upton. If we could, I'd like to start off in your personal career in the NFL, and then we'll work backwards a little bit later and talk about your family in your early life. But in the early NFL, you started off in your early 20s with your role at the Baltimore Colts. And if there's anything you have to share with us, because you work with some real legends, you know, Don Shula, Johnny Unitas, Bubba Smith, Earl Morrill, Bill Curry, John Mackey, Weeb Eubank, and even a young coach named Chuck Knoll. If you could talk about those early Colts days, we'd really appreciate it.
Well, one of the things that I talked in my book about is those, there's a couple of chapters in the beginning on those early days, and it's ironic because In the early fall of 1959, my father dropped dead at a game at Franklin Field where he was the quarterback years before for Penn, playing, watching the two teams, the Philadelphia Eagles that he founded and the Pittsburgh Steelers that he owned with Art Rooney before he became commissioner. He died in the last 2 minutes of the game. And after that, of course, a lot of people mourned around America, particularly in the NFL. And Carol Rosenblum, who was the owner of the Baltimore Colts, invited me to come to their training camp in my senior year in college in 1960. This is right after they had won back-to-back world championships. And it looked like they were on their way to their next one. And it's interesting about Rosenblum, because Rosenblum was a running back at the University of Pennsylvania when my father later became a coach. And Rosenblum was going to leave Penn and go to Notre Dame with Marty Brill, who was a very famous running back of his time, because they were unhappy with the coaching. And my father convinced Rosenblum to stay. He said, listen, nobody will know you out at Notre Dame, but they'll know you here. You're from around here. You're a Baltimore guy. You're a Philly guy. Stay here. So years later, when they were bringing the Colts back to Baltimore, Bert Bell called Rosenblum, who was running his father's firm in Baltimore, and said, listen, you're a Baltimore guy. I need somebody locally. I am not going to give a franchise back to Baltimore, who had already failed once, unless you are part of it. Finally, he got Rosenblum to agree, and the rest is, of course, history. Rosenblum himself ended up, he was a full partner in business ventures with Joseph P. Kennedy. He was a great friend of the president's. I mean, there was so much history there. But basically, when I went to the first training camp in my senior year and saw, you know, who was there? Alan the Horse Amici, Gino Marchetti, Big Daddy Lipscomb, Johnny Unitas. You talk about all the players I talk about today, whether it's Tom Brady and everything else. There was such an accumulation of great stars.
It's almost an all-star squad you had there.
Well, I'm not Jim Parker, probably one of the 10 greatest offensive linemen of all time. And you go right through that roster. And
now was Art Donovan still there at that time when you started?
Art Donovan was there, and a lot of people don't know that Art Donovan's father, Arthur Donovan Sr., was the foremost referee of his time, who refereed including Joe Louis, Max Snelling fights, Dempsey all the way back, actually was a referee for 10 of the biggest fights in that time in history. So all of these people were there, and it was an amazing time, because it looked like we might be the only team in history at that time to go three straight championships. The Eagles had done it back in the 40s, but for the Colts to do it, of course, playing in the most iconic game still today in history, the sudden death game, which my father put the rule in for that game. Well, I mean, he put it in many years earlier. But all of this came, and it was like this moment in history when I walked in there as a kid, just 22 years old, and in my senior year of college, and basically started out working in their PR department and running errands for their different business stuff that they had to do on the road. And it was really an education. But the thing to me was, I've been around football players my whole life, so I wasn't in awe of them. I enjoyed being around them. They were incredible characters, the type today that you wouldn't see, because they would not be bothering with social media or Twitter every time that they coughed. You know, they were people like Gino Marchetti, and Marchetti at the age of 17 fought in the Battle of the Bulge. 17.
Oh, wow.
Art Donovan fought in the Battle of the Midway. These were men that were fully men. They weren't boys. They were men. And when they came back after the war, and were part eventually of this team, it was something to see them, you know, interact. And again, you might have for a practice in the summer of 1960, you might have 10,000 people just for a practice. Now today, you know, because the NFL is so publicized, you know, you see huge crowds for different teams, whether it's Denver or here with the Patriots. But then think about it. 10,000 people for practice, and everybody, they knew their names. They were part of the crowd. There was no separation like you have today. There was a love affair that you will never see again. And I have never seen in all the years from 1960, we're talking about 60 years ago. I can tell you, I have been through every iteration of the NFL, of football, of sports, of interviewing, and I will tell you, there will never be another love affair like that. And not only that, today the players are protected. If they go to a bar, they go to a restaurant, you know, they've got people around to make sure nobody gets near them. Then players drank with the fans, they ate with the fans, they talked to the fans.
They're much more approachable back in that era.
Well, they were regular, they're blue-collar guys. They weren't making great money. As great as those Colt teams were, and, you know, they got, at that time, a lot of people had them sponsor their products and stuff like that. But almost up to the sudden death championship game in 1958, every one of those players had a second job. I mean, John Unitas and many of the players, you know, went down and worked the steel mills. You know, they had a second job. Jim Mutchler, our tight end, sold insurance. Art Donovan had what he called was a country club. I say it's just a bar out in the middle of nowhere. You know, every one of them, Gino Marchetti, Rosenblum lent him money. Eventually, he and Alan Amici found these drive-in restaurants, Gino's Food and AG Foods, and eventually they moved to Philadelphia and they all became millionaires. But there was just amazing. You know, Big Daddy Lipscomb after practice would do magic acts for the fans, and tell stories. And we had a basketball team, you had a softball team. And the team went everywhere to not only promote the product, but they and the fans are one and the same. You'll never see it again. Too bad, but you won't see it.
Now, do you think that popularity of the Colts back then, do you think that's a direct result of that overtime championship game that they played a few years earlier?
It was a love affair way before then.
Was that okay?
Baltimore was a blue-collar town in the middle of, in between Philadelphia and Washington. Everybody bypassed Baltimore. They had an inferiority complex. They were blue collar, but they looked at, they were them Colts. They were, they were their team. You know, they were in love with them before, as they say in the Tom Cruise movie, you had me at hello. You know, it was just, and I am not one of those people that now sits back 60 years later and says, oh, it was all better then. It wasn't all better then. It was just an era that was a great love affair. And other teams in the NFL, but the Colts were different. They were, and Unitas, maybe even up to Tom Brady today, Drew Brees, Aaron Rodgers, Unitas was like the guy that walked down the street in High Noon, the famous movie, and took on the bad guys. And he had very little to say except when he stepped on the field. So, I mean, every one of them were great characters in themselves, and they were not for sale.
And they just made a great team. Now, that had to be quite a transition, going from that atmosphere with Baltimore when you went into the Patriots organization, and you became what I believe was the youngest general manager in the NFL at the time. If you could talk about that.
At the time, it was like going from Miami Beach to Alaska. I mean, it was completely different. And I understood partially what I was getting into, not wholly, but the problem with the Patriots, the day that I arrived for my press conference, I picked up a Boston Globe newspaper, and the paper said the Bay State Patriots. And then they had a headline, the BS Patriots. And I said to myself, oh, my God, the first thing I have to do is to, talk to the owners. And unfortunately, there were like 32 owners and directors.
Wow.
And that's not good to have that type of situation. And I said, I've got to convince them to change the name. And I finally was able to convince them to change it to the New England Patriots, because we were moving from Boston to Foxborough, which is right in the middle of Boston and Providence. And I said, we've got to be able to draw from all over New England now that we're no longer in Boston. So let's get rid of that Bay State Patriots name and let's rename it the New England Patriots. And they did.
Well, that is incredible. You have probably, of the last couple decades, the most iconic football team of this generation, and you helped name at least the beginning part of their name. That is truly incredible. Now, I'd like to transition now back to your family's early life. And something you said the other day in our conversation preparing for this discussion was that your grandfather had played a role in early college football's development, pre-NCAA. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, actually, the most famous group of their time was called the Walter Camp Rules Committee. And ironically, Walter Camp was the man that actually controlled college football, which was a totally different game then. My grandfather, John C. Bell Sr., was a part of the Walter Camp Rules Committee and was second in seniority. Now, they were the forerunner of the modern NCAA. And when players died in the early 1900s, Teddy Roosevelt, the president, had said that basically he was going to ban college football. And so what Camp did, along with my grandfather on my father's side, John C. Bell, they negotiated with Teddy to change certain rules in football so it wouldn't be such a brutal game, which it was then. If you think it's bad today, or if you think it was bad way before that, even though they had, leather helmets, the game was, very close together. So there were no receivers, there's no real passing game. You just beat the hell out of the person, and anything went. So basically, my grandfather, John C. Bell, negotiated with Walter Camp, with Teddy Roosevelt, to change the rules of the game. And then he was the founder. And it's one other book that people should read, because it's written by a Philadelphia Associated Press writer, Bob Lyons, is called Bert Bell's Famous Term on Any Given Sunday. In that book, he details how Walter Camp, but with the help of John Cromwell Bell, was able to change the rules, and that actually my grandfather founded what is today the modern NCAA.
Wow. That is some deep family history in the gridiron. Now, going back to when Roosevelt had the meeting with Camp and your grandfather and a handful of others, there was sort of two divisions from what I understand, where some, like John Heisman and I think Amos Alonzo Stagg, wanted to introduce the forward pass into the game to open it up a little bit, make it a little safer, where Camp and others thought that would sissify the game. Do you know what side your grandfather was in that argument?
I think he was on the side of the forward pass, because it would take out some of the brutality of the game. In fact, it's ironic that when my father's career was through at Penn as their quarterback, that he ended up on the Penn staff, and the head coach was John Heisman of the Heisman Trophy.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
And of course, my father favored the rules, because when he was a quarterback at Penn, Bert Bell was the first man to ever throw a pass in Rose Bowl history in 1917, when Penn and the Ivy League at that time was one of the powers in America.
Absolutely.
Played Oregon, and they lost 14-0, but I'm still looking, because somebody said that NBC might have a film that shows Bert Bell throwing the first forward pass in that 1917
really?
Game. So he was big on the forward pass. And
wow.
He was big on it when he became an owner and commissioner of the NFL, because he saw the future of the NFL and football was the forward pass.
Well, that's a great story, and it's a great segue, because one of the reasons that we brought you on, we're going to be airing this episode on February 25th, and what we commonly do on every one of our episodes is we talk about the birthdays of Hall of Famers for that particular day, and February 25th is very special to your father. I believe that is his date of birth, and that's why we want to honor him with having you on. So now I'd like to sort of turn that attention I guess first we got to talk about your mother, because from what I understand, she played a major part in the way football is today.
Well, when you look back at the Bells and the Uptons, you will see history. And there are people right now looking at it as a documentary and maybe a movie.
Oh, I can believe it.
History on both sides. Here's Frances Upton, the daughter of Frank Upton, who spoke seven languages, never finished high school, and yet became chief of detectives in New York City during the 1900s.
Wow.
And his father, my grandfather on the other side, wrote a book that became famous and is still out there 120 years later. Tell your listeners to look up this other book called Uncle Pat's Cabin. And her, William Cleary Upton, from Ireland, wrote a book damning the British for the way they treated the Irish tenant farmers. And then later on, with a group of Fenians, tried to blow up a British police station, was thrown out of Ireland, came to New York. And my grandfather, he was my great-grandfather. My grandfather, Frank Upton, my mother's father, also was one of 11 children. They all survived in New York and were part of the great immigrant, a group that came in the late 1880s and early 1900s. So she at the time was working in the department store Macy's at the perfume counter, and she was really stunning as a teenager. And coming through there was a talent scout, actually for the Schubert Theaters, and said, you know, you're a beautiful woman. He said, do you have any experience? And she said, well, I'm taking ballet lessons in high school, and I want to become an actress someday. 4 years later, she was a star on Broadway at the age of 21.
Wow.
I mean, it just doesn't happen that way anymore. So
no.
she ended up being one of the top Ziegfeld Follies women of her time. She was in shows with Eddie Cantor, Ruth Etting, all the major people of her time, Fanny Bryce. And she was so famous. Again, if your listeners want to go online to YouTube and type in Frances Upton Nightwork, they will see she also made one of the first talking movies in Hollywood.
Wow.
Was a comedian in that too. So at the time that she met my father, she was engaged to one of the richest men's son in America, Bernard Baruch, who was an advisor to President Roosevelt.
Okay.
And she actually broke her engagement to Bernard Baruch Jr., to basically marry a man whose father was one of the most wealthy people in Philadelphia, but it cut him off from his inheritance because he had lost $100,000 in the stock market crash in 1929. And basically, she took a gamble, and they got secretly married while she was on the stage, because in those days, you needed permission from Flo Ziegfeld to get married. And so as she was on the road, and actually, her roommate, people remember maybe or look it up on Turner Classic Movies, Love Me or Leave Me with James Cagney and Doris Day. Day played Ruth Etting. Ruth Etting was my mother's roommate when they were on the road.
Wow, really?
And actually, they both slept on the road with guns under their pillows for fear that Moe the Gimp Snyder, played in the movie by Jimmy Cagney, would break in and shoot them. He was so jealous of Ruth Etting. So actually,
oh my goodness,
she introduced my father in some ways to pro football. In those days, college football was it. Red Grange, the Wheaton Icemen, you know, all of it was around college. Pro football, they kind of laughed at. But
right.
She said to him, you know, you've got to see the Chicago Bears. You've got to see some of these teams. So they end up going to games together. And eventually, she broke her engagement to Bernard Baruch's son. But she said, you know what? I don't marry people who gamble, and I don't marry drunks. And you're a drunk, and you gamble too much. So he called her with his friends from Atlantic City, which then was a big, was kind of a big gambling town, not like today.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I've got all my friends here, Francis, and I promise I will never gamble again, and I will never take a drink the rest of my life if you'll marry me. And she said, I'm putting you on probation, we'll see. That was 19, I want to say, 31, 32. He never had a drink the rest of his life. Never. There was
wow.
no alcohol in our house. There was nothing. He just had the, you know, the great ability when he made up his mind that he was going to do it. Great discipline. So eventually they get married secretly. And then when the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets were in bankruptcy in 19, I think 34, 35, they both of them went to the bankruptcy. She put up the money, I think it was $3,200, to buy the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets. And on their way back from the bankruptcy, they were walking by a sign that showed the National Recovery Act, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's National Recovery Act Eagle. And that's how you found the Eagles, because he said that's going to be the name of the team.
Just by seeing the sign. Wow. That is quite a story. Now, I mean, from what I understand, our listeners, a lot of them listening to the football history dude, Arnie Chapman, who I know you've been on. And in that, you told of a story where your parents had football players living at your home when you were a youngster. If you could tell us a little bit about that, it's a fascinating story.
Well, when I first was born in 1937, I lived in a hotel, because his father owned the Ritz-Carlton, which was the landmark in Philadelphia on Broad Street for many, many years. In fact, stories were written about it. Many of the famous stars of those days, whether it was Bob Hope came to town or Cesar Romero or all of Fannie Bryce, any of them, they would stay there. They had the famous Ritz-Carlton roof. But because he had lost all his money and now he was about to buy the Eagles, when I was born, that was 2 years after the Eagles. Basically, I lived in a hotel, which was great with me. I loved it. What the hell do I care?
Right.
And I lived there, I think, till I was like 4 years old. And then basically, to save money, you know, we lived in the same house with 33 players. And ironically, the day my father died, the last person that I saw him with was his starting offensive center, Bo Lipsky, who was actually down on his luck and asked my father if he could borrow some money. And my father said to him, here, took it out of his money clip because nobody had credit cards in 1959.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave him everything out of there and said, see me on Monday. Well, Bull Lipsky, the starting offensive center, made an extra $5 a week. Why? Because he was Upton Bell and Burt Bell Jr.'s babysitter. So, I mean, to me, in some ways, I was never really a child. I was kind of an adult because I was around players all the time and I was used to it, and it was no big deal. But when I tell people that today, they're shocked.
Yeah.
You lived in the same house with 33 players? I said, yeah. You know, people doubled up. I mean, there were all sorts of things. But it was a different time.
Well, that's incredible. It's unfathomable how, I mean, I'm sure my listeners are probably sitting back just like I am saying, I mean, that's incredible. Now, I would be remiss. I mean, I live in Western Pennsylvania, and this is, you know, my family's big Steelers fans, and I know that your father had a great relationship with Mr. Art Rooney, the founder of the Steelers, and even was co-owner with him for some time. If you could tell a little bit about Art Rooney and your dad's relationship.
Greatest friend Burt Bell ever had was Art Rooney. They were like blood brothers. And and again, ironically, the day my father died, the last person he sat with before he moved from Rooney's owner's box over to kind of the end zone, Rooney was the last guy I think he saw before he died. And
oh, my goodness.
They used to talk to each other each day, every day. And my father had three or four phones in the house. I could hear all the conversation. He would try out everything on Rooney before he would try to push it through with the rest of the owners. And actually, I mean, the Fort Pitt Hotel, I don't know what is still there in Pittsburgh, is where Rooney had his boxing club too. You know, Rooney was a terrific amateur boxer.
And, I didn't know that.
Also owned a big boxing club. And in the same office would be Rooney's boxing club. And he and my father's football venture, the Steelers. So basically, they went through hard times together. You know, they merged their team during the war. They merged the Eagles and the Steelers. And they called them the Steelers. There's a book written about it. And then later on, they had the Pitt Cardinals. And in the second year of the war, World War II, they merged those teams. Rooney was a rugged individualist. Everybody loved him. No airs about him. Would walk right down from that same house that he had. Even when the Steelers were winning Super Bowls and worth millions of dollars, Rooney still lived in the same house on the hill and walked down every day to the office and practice. He was just an amazing man. I mean, you're so lucky to have, and there's still Rooney's in the area where you are in Western Pennsylvania. In fact, Art Rooney Jr., the son of Art Rooney Sr. and I are still good friends, and we still converse and still go back and forth on email. So, but Rooney was really important to him. Actually, they joined the league at the same time in 1933. They both bought their franchises in. And Rooney's original name for the Steelers was not the Steelers, it was the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Right, yeah.
So I mean, they were like blood brothers all the way through. And I'm so glad in a game and today where, you know, it's all billionaires that own their teams. And, you know, many of them, it's much new money and 32 franchises, that Pittsburgh still has the original Rooney family. That's important. I will tell all your listeners from Western Pennsylvania that some multi-billionaire didn't come in there that doesn't know what Pittsburgh is, doesn't know what Western Pennsylvania is, doesn't know about the steel mills and the hardship and the tough times that Western Pennsylvania has gone through. And my father knew that, and that's why he and Rooney were just, they were inseparable.
That's some great stories, and I'm sure everybody here in Pennsylvania would love to hear those. Now, I'd like to go over some of your father's accomplishments, because he left quite a legacy on the NFL, some things that we might not even realize that he did. If you could share some of those great innovations that he did for the game.
Well, first and foremost, I don't think any sport, and people have talked about this, he's in everybody's book. He's on everybody's list of the greatest commissioners of all time. I don't think there has ever been a commissioner like Burt Bell or a unique person like Burt Bell. He wielded power that you would never have today, number one, because he proved that he could do it. In fact, it's interesting. I've been called by the Hall of Fame that has been interested. When their 50th anniversary book came out, of the 10 major decisions, and the major reasons for the success of the Hall of Fame, six of them were Burt Bell. Six
wow.
of his decisions on what he did. First and foremost, if he did nothing in his life as commissioner except found the pro football draft, he would be a first ballot Hall of Famer. In fact, Arthur Daly of the New York Times said that was Burt Bell's legacy, that he founded the draft, saved the NFL when most of the teams were going to go under. And basically, here we have it today, where thousands of people attend the NFL draft. It's publicized by the NFL Network. And I guarantee you, until I did a piece for them about 4 years ago, nobody knows that Burt Bell was the one that made it all possible. Because I can tell you, at that time, the Giants and the Bears and occasionally Green Bay dominated football and all the other teams. Like the Steelers, like the Eagles, like the Boston, at that time Redskins, they were about to go out of business. And he said, we're only as strong as our weakest link. And he convinced the owners in 1935 to go to a draft. Every league today, every league has a draft.
And every sport even. I mean,
as I say, yeah.
Yeah.
And so what he did is he not only saved the NFL, but he set the future. But he had a mind that was, Darren, so far in advance of everybody else that
wow.
he saw television as the savior of pro football. But you, when you look at it, the NFL draft, the waiver wire is still around today. Ex-FBI men that he put in each city when he stopped the 1946 championship game and the thought that it was fixed. And Cole went to New York and sat down with Frank Hogan, the district attorney, the night before the game and decided to suspend one player and the other one he let play. But right after that, he hired ex-FBI men in every city to report bribes and stuff with players or gamblers and really put a stop to a situation that could have killed pro football. So he put in the waiver wire and demanded every team back in 1946 turn in who was injured, who wasn't, every week by Thursday. That's still there. We're talking 1946.
Right.
It's still there. Every lake city has security there to check and see what is going on. He put in all sorts of, he had the first television network.
If I could just stop you right there, just a thought on that with the, you know, that championship game where he had the two players investigating for trying to not reporting the bribes that were offered to them. That was very early in his tenure as commissioner, was it not? That was his
first year. He
yeah.
had just been named commissioner. But he the thing that made him, in my opinion, better than any commissioner in history, he'd been an owner. He'd been a player. He'd been a general manager. He'd been all of those things and knew the vicissitudes of what it was like not to be a wealthy owner, to struggle. I mean, he once played a game that had less than 1,000 people and actually wanted to cancel the game because he had no tickets sold. And actually, it's a true story. You can look it up by Arthur Daly that they were in 36, 37, they were due to play the Brooklyn Dodgers. Yes, there was a Brooklyn Dodgers football team owned at that time by Dan Topping, who later became the New York Yankees owner. And they basically, my father called him and said, can you cancel this game or let's put it off for a week or so? And he said, I can't. My father said, why? He said, it's raining here and we haven't sold a ticket. And we're playing in Municipal Stadium in Philadelphia, home of the Army-Navy game that has 100,000 seats. He said, this is ridiculous. He said, I can't do it because I promised my new fiancée, Sonia Henning, Olympic skating star. Mm-hmm. So I just got engaged and I promised to bring her to the game. My father said, for Christ's sake, who cares about that? He said, you've got to play the game. So the night before the game, he basically... what Topping said to him was, and Arthur Daly witnesses, he said, I'll tell you what, let's flip for it. If you win the coin toss, can you imagine this?
No, that's incredible.
You win the coin toss, we don't play the game. I win and we play the game. And my father said, I can't do that. So they played the game. It was a nothing tie in a driving rainstorm, and there were less than 1,000 people there. So he was, I think, the greatest of commissioners because today you're either a lawyer or a PR person or something like that. I will say that I thought Pete Rozelle did a great job succeeding my father and taking on his thing. But basically, he knew the game from every aspect because he had been a player. He had been a coach. He had been a general manager. He had been an owner. He knew what it was like to lose money. He knew players. So when he was faced with crises, he had all the answers because basically he would put into play what his experience was. Nobody's ever had that.
He sort of lived in that old saying where you don't know till you've lived in another man's shoes. He's lived in all those men's shoes, that all those different aspects and players and owners.
He could handle a crisis. He was the first to recognize over the owner's objection. He recognized the Players Association when the owners, a couple of them threatened it to fire him. He said, go ahead and fire me. I don't care. But this is the right thing to do. I mean, that's why his name, the Burke Bell pension plan, which they finally, they later on put Pete Rozelle on it. Why, I don't know. But basically, he was for the players, he was for the owners, he was fair to everybody. But his, even with the coming of the AFL, he was the one that announced in Congress that there was going to be a new league. He negotiated with Lamar Hunt, who wanted him to be commissioner of both leagues, but he told Hunt he couldn't do it at the time. But again, one of his ex-players, Davey O'Brien, who was a great little quarterback for him in the 30s, ended up going to work for the FBI and was one of the best pistol shooters in America. He was the go-between between Lamar Hunt and Burt Bell, as far as the new league was concerned. So in every major, he was the first person to register himself as a full-time lobbyist in Washington for the NFL. He used to get on the train every Monday and go down to Washington and appear for before the different subcommittees. He knew Lyndon Johnson. He knew presidents. He knew everybody.
Wow. Now he had a rival league, another rival league before the AFL. The AAFC come up in the, believe it was the late 40s.
It was right after the war. And it was the old All-America Conference that he negotiated that merger. Or that both leagues might have gone under. And basically that was the league that Paul Brown, along with others, founded. And Brown took the Cleveland Browns and led them to 10 straight championships in the old All-America Conference, 4 there and 6 in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he could see that if he could affect the merger with them and take their best teams in, which were the Browns, the 49ers, and at one time the old Colts, and
right.
Basically do that, end the war, because a lot of people thought that All-America Conference was really better football than the NFL at that time. So he was able to do that and then promote it and then started his negotiations for big television contracts.
That's incredible. Now, I just want to, once again, I want to thank you. We're truly honored that you were able to join us and share your personal and your family's gridiron history. I mean, you're going all the way back to the beginning, the roots of college football with your great-grandfather and your grandfather and your father and everything that you've done for the game. I mean, we really appreciate you coming on today, paying great tribute to your father on his birthday and hearing about all your history. And thank you very much for spending all your time with us today, and we appreciate it. And
hey, about a big hello to Western Pennsylvania. I love it. I've been out there many times. Love Pittsburgh. Been to Erie. I've been all over Pennsylvania. It's really, you know, it's, even though I've lived in Boston for almost 50 years, Pennsylvania's in my heart. I'm a Philly guy.
Well, we are proud to have you as one of our fellow statesmen. And I'd like to make sure I remind everybody again, your book, Present at the Creation, My Life in the NFL and the Rise of America's Game, that's on Amazon and every other big bookstore online and at the actual stores themselves. Your Twitter handle is @UptonBell, and you have some great some tweets that I look at every day, and I'm quite you're quite enjoyable, and we appreciate that. And you can also go to the www.umass.edu, go in the search bar under Upton Bell, you'll see his collections that that Upton's donated to those colleges, which is a museum among itself, and I'm going to have to get up there someday and check that out firsthand.
So, do that. And by the way, also, I do commentary for Sports Raconteurs. If they go online and see that, I do it every Tuesday. And I not only cover all the playoffs, but all of the controversy, whether it's on Twitter or on Sports Raconteurs, they might try that out sometime.
Okay. We'll make sure we do that. Upton Bell, we thank you once again for your time, and thank you for sharing that great history with us.
Thank you.
Well, that interview was just awesome. It still gives me goosebumps just thinking about the family history that the Bell family's endured. I mean, starting off with his grandfather being in the rule revision rooms with Walter Camp and sharing a football field with players like Camp and Amos Alonzo Stagg and sitting in that presidential Oval Office with Teddy Roosevelt, you know, breathing down your neck, say, hey, you got to change this game, and instituting things like the forward pass, to going to his father with, you know, buying the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, him and his mother, and just, you know, creating the Philadelphia Eagles and naming them. And then, you know, Upton's personal history of just, wow, some fantastic things with the Baltimore Colts and renaming the New England Patriots, or naming the New England Patriots to what they're called to this day. Phenomenal, phenomenal personality Upton Bell is. And like I said, catch him on Twitter because he is fantastic. Read his books and enjoy these interviews that right here and some of our other places where you have them, and his radio program that he has every week. It's just some great stuff from Mr. Upton Bell, and we really appreciate him being able to join us and spend some of his valuable time with us to share that awesome family football history that he has. And I don't know where to end it from here, because that was just tremendous, and we're glad that we could present that to you. So make sure you check us out at pigskindispatch.com/podcast. You can see all of our podcasts for the Pigskin Dispatch podcast all in one place. You can do some binge listening, some other great interviews we have, and some great solos. And you can also see all of our podcasts on the sportshistorynetwork.com, where we have right now 16 other great podcasts besides this one on there, talking about sports history of every single genre of sports. You'll find something that you like, and you'll get to enjoy some great sports history with some excellent personalities of the hosts and some excellent guests. So until tomorrow, everybody, have a great Gridiron Day. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck, because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.